Great, thank you. So while it's just my name on this front slide, I want to start by actually acknowledging all the contributors to my thinking. So what I'm presenting today is a bit of a synthesis of thinking over the past decade, and many people have contributed to this in many different ways. So they could all technically be listed as co-authors. So here's the punchline, then you can go to sleep for the rest of the talk. What I'm going to try to say today is that cropping systems experiments, both short and long, have made important contributions. I think Merle's talk just was a great example of that. But also want to talk about how our goals of cropping systems studies have shifted over time to include a broader suite of functions that we're looking for from our cropping systems. And to reflect this change, we need different analytical tools. So just to prep you, I'm going to go through about four or five specific examples of different analytical tools that we've used, and then talk a little bit about how long-term data sets are going to be critical for assessing environmental biomanagement interactions and how this is particularly important in semi-arid systems. So, what's a systems experiment? Systems experiments compares a suite of management practices as a unit. So, often you change one thing, whether it's till versus no-till, but changing that one thing means you're actually changing other things as well, whether it's your herbicide program or your timing or something. And so these cropping systems experiments allow us to assess the relative effect of these management systems in a comparative way. These experiments are typically research or designed and implemented, but I also think it's important to realize that they're often influenced by producer practice. So, and it's often the innovative producers that we're trying to emulate and look at what might be the next frontier in thinking about different management practices on the landscape. So I'll come back a few times to talk about this one experiment that I've been lucky enough to walk into at Colorado State. It's been around for 30 years now. And so, let's see if I get this thing working. Maybe. I think my fingers aren't warm enough. There we go. Okay. So what is typical of most cropping systems experiments is that they are comparing different cropping systems, right? This one in eastern Colorado is also unique because it does that across a couple different soil variables, so a summit, a side slope, and a toe slope, so different topographic positions. And then it's at three locations in eastern Colorado, so it has a climate gradient as well, and it's been done over a long period of time. So these are different components that are part of different cropping systems experiments. But I'm going to start by talking mostly about how we've compared cropping systems in particular. So our long-term experiments have contributed greatly to our understanding, particularly of how different systems impact productivity and impact soils. And why soils? Partially it's my bias, and that's the literature I look at, probably. But also because it's a very slow change variable, right? And so it's these longer-term experiments that allow us to see differences. So our till and no-till experiments, like Marl was just showing a lot of data, have been really important in telling us about the dynamics of soil carbon change, aggregation dynamics, and how those different tillage practices impact soil carbon pools. Other experiments have looked at rotation intensity, rotational diversity, and those impacts on soil carbon and water use efficiency. And then there are other ones that are looking at input intensities, management systems like legume-based, manure-based, versus synthetic fertilizer-based systems, like the bottom picture there from the Rodale experiment is also another example of a cropping system study that's been really pivotal in our understanding of some how these management systems impact some of these slow change variables like soil carbon. And then there are also shorter-term experiments that live the life of a grant, right, 3 to 4 years, and those have also been really important. So this is just one example project that I came in on the tail end of it, Penn State, looking at full till versus reduced till systems with an initial cover crop of annual cover crops versus perennial cover crops during the 3-year transition from conventional to organic management. And that type of shorter term system was really important in looking at the profitability and productivity, weed control, and various factors during a shorter time frame that's critical for management. So that study in particular was analyzed for weeds, it was analyzed for soils, it was analyzed for profitability. Similar to this one, this data set from the long-term cropping systems in Colorado, which has looked at soil carbon in a two-year wheat fallow. So similar to some of the systems Merle was just talking about, wheat fallow versus a wheat corn fallow versus a wheat corn millet fallow being that four-year versus continuous crop systems. And over that first 12 years of the experiment, you can see this nice stair step in soil carbon. And using ANOVA, analysis of variance, being our typical way that we analyze these, could see that that was clearly due to increases in soil carbon in that very surface 0 to 2.5 centimeter soil layer. So, again, very important outcomes, but now I want to encourage you to think beyond ANOVA a little bit. So when we think about doing ANOVAs, they compare groups, right? They compare discrete groups, and this is a Wordle of the different terms that you might think of when you think of ANOVAs, and there are a couple terms that are missing from there, I'm going to say, which is interactions and dynamics. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about those things and how we might analyze that. And again, going back to this idea that if we look back over the long-term history of cropping systems experiments, going back to the Rothamsted experiments and other ones, productivity has always been a mainstay outcome that we've been looking at in these experiments. Sustainability has also become an important output indicator we've looked at. But it's more recently we've been looking at sort of multiple functions, environmental impacts, adaptation to climate change, and other outcomes. And so another way to visualize this is that, historically we look to our ag lands to produce crops, and now we're asking more of them in terms of what they're producing, whether it's water quality regulation, carbon sequestration, or biodiversity habitat, for example. So what are the tools we can use to look at multiple functions? One is a pretty straightforward, just similar to that diagram where we can use radar plots, or I call them spider plots, but they have multiple different names, where we put multiple functions on a single graph, single visualization. So we use this type to look at a three-year cropping system in Pennsylvania context with and without cover crops. So this is the system without cover crops in red, and then the blue is the system with cover crops. And we estimated, and this was actually more of a modeling exercise, the relative impact of those different cropping systems on multiple functions. So these spider plots can be really useful for visualizing multiple functions. Here's an example from the Kellogg Biological Station long-term cropping systems experiments comparing conventional, no-till, reduced input, and organic systems using experimental data. And so the area, the shaded blue area, kind of gives you a sense of the multifunctionality of those different systems and how many produced, you know, which systems produced more of those functions. Then taking that to another step, you can take those normalized functions and actually come up with an index. So this is one example where someone took a soil biodiversity, again, a soil biodiversity index is on the x-axis here, and then took those normalized radar plot axes and combine them into one average sort of indicator of multifunctionality and looked at a correlation there to say, well, as soil biodiversity increased, the number of functions they were getting from their system increased. So this is just one example, and I think I'm going to go through each of these and then give you some pros and cons where I think they're useful and where they're not. So for this one, it's a very useful tool for visualizing data. We've used it in extension events. I've used it working with NRCS groups to think about what different factors, different cropping systems value. What's important, for example, in the northern central Great Plains might be very different from the variables you might put on that graph in Pennsylvania. Water wasn't even on our plot vector in Pennsylvania, as an example. So they're really effective for visualizing multiple functions and comparing these relative effects. What they don't do is they don't look at interactions, and it treats all those functions that you put on there as equal. And we all know yield and profitability really matter, and those are weighted equally in those multifunctionality scores to mycorrhizal colonization and all of those other variables on there, which I think to some extent we still don't know the relative importance of some of those other variables. So it doesn't look at interactions, and it weights everything equally. So if we want to dive into the weeds then and look at interactions, there's some other tools we can use. So when we think about cropping systems experiments, we're looking at management practices. We're placing that over multiple years, so we're getting climate and other abiotic factors. And we know those influence multiple functions, and that in turn influences productivity. So here's an example where we used that sort of conceptual model and used a path analysis approach again on a cropping system study to look at the impact of initial cover crop and tillage system. So this is going back to that three-year transition to organic management system I mentioned earlier in Pennsylvania. And we could hypothesize that tillage would probably have a negative impact on soil quality, and that in turn might impact crop yields. Tillage might also then reduce tillage, might foster greater organic matter content. Organic matter is a food source or resource for some of our arthropods. Arthropods are good seed predators. They might impact our weed dynamics. That might impact yield. So to what extent are what's driving what, basically? So trying to get at some of the mechanisms and tease apart, are arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi important in those no-till systems, for example, like that question. Can we try to pull that out, the relative importance of these different factors? So we took this mental model, and we tested it with our data. And so what dropped out quickly was that initial cover crop didn't matter by the end of the experiment. So that's not in our model anymore. Tillage was in our model. Start here represents a site by year effect. So sort of our abiotic factor. And that was important also. So some take homes, the numbers here are sort of correlation coefficients. It's a direct correlation coefficient if it's here. It's a partial correlation coefficient if it's sort of a secondary effect. The boxes here are what proportion of the variability is explained. So for example, this model explains 64% of our corn yield in this experiment. So some take-homes from this was that tillage did have a negative impact on our soil quality, but that did not feed back to our arthropods. It did not feed back to our yields in that short-term study. But what was important was tillage reduced perennial weeds, and perennial weeds had a strong negative impact on corn yields. So that was an important mediating function in that experiment, where it was the weed pressure that really dictated the end outcomes in those experiments. There was a direct effect of tillage, which may have been aeration or other factors on yield, but it was less than that indirect effect via weeds. So that's one example of how we can do it. Taking it a step further, there's also structural equation modeling, which allows you to define latent variables, which are sort of composite variables such as soil quality, that amorphous term of soil quality that's out there, and allows you to basically say, well, soil quality really influences organic carbon, bulk density, and water-stable aggregates. So if we use those combined measurable things, we can say something about soil quality and then use that actually in our model. So structural equation modeling just takes it to another step beyond the path analysis in terms of coming up with sort of composite variables in there. So some pros and cons of this type of approach. It tests our conceptual frameworks of direct and indirect effects of multiple variables. So it's starting to get at some of those interactions. It often requires data sets that might be larger than we might have for some of our cropping systems experiments. And it was a method that was largely developed in more of the social sciences. It's been used more in the ecological sciences. But I do think in certain cases, there, in, with simplified questions and hypotheses, you can have some nice patterns come out when using it in cropping system studies. One of the cautions, it's not meant for data mining any relationship you might ever find in your data. So you have to be very cognizant and define those expected relationships beforehand, and they have to be something you can, you know, have a justification for, where you can't just put an arrow going every direction because you can find lots of spurious results. So it has to be applied with some caution and some a priori thinking. Okay, so then I talked about management practices, their impacts on ecosystem functions and how that impacts yield. I want to talk a little bit more as how we get at this abiotic piece in our experiments, because most of our cropping system studies, as I said, are in one location. And so I think the next talks are going to get at this a little bit more, but using on-farm sites can be really valuable as another way to think about cropping system studies, because often those on-farm sites have been in the same management system for at least a decade. So individual farms might reflect long-term study sites effectively. If we have enough, we can sort of tease out management versus abiotic effects and look at the relative impact of those two different factors. So this is an example I want to talk about where we used a gradient of management practices in terms of nitrogen inputs, and this was in upstate New York, where we had farm fields that used only synthetic nitrogen inputs, those that had synthetic fertilizers plus legumes in rotation, legume nitrogen inputs, and those that relied almost exclusively on legume nitrogen inputs. We looked at nitrogen balances over a five-year period to sort of characterize those in terms of their nitrogen input intensities and across 17 different farm fields. And we could use principal components analysis in this type where we're looking at a lot of variability and a lot of data. So we have variability in our soil types and we have variability in our management. And so this principal components analysis basically allows you to separate all those variables on independent axes. And so a way to interpret this is our principal component one on our x-axis here has sand way over here, clay, which is very correlated with our total carbon over here. So that first component is really our soil texture gradient, okay? And then our second variable, our y-axis here, really reflected what we called sort of our nitrogen availability. Nitrogen has so many different indicators. We used free particulate organic matter and occluded particulate organic matter, as well as microbial biomass as indicators of sort of more labile nitrogen input. And you'll see the second axis this way really reflects that nitrogen availability differences. And then we can plot on there our sites, and what I want you to focus on is the open triangles, which is our Haber-Bosch nitrogen, so our synthetic nitrogen-based field sites versus our legume-based, and they separate not so much by texture. There was no statistical difference in terms of how they fell across the texture gradient, but the systems with more legume-based history did have higher nitrogen indices across those sites. So this is just one tool to sort of partition some of that variability across heterogeneous sites. And then we can use those principal components in regressions. So we could use that principal component looking at nitrogen availability and compare that to that management information we had of what percentage of the total nitrogen inputs into that farm field came from legumes versus other sources, and we found a positive correlation, indicating that that management gradient was driving increases in soil nitrogen availability across that site. And we also had a similar positive relationship in terms of crop nitrogen uptake. So this is just an example of how to use principal components to look at heterogeneous on-farm sites. There are a lot of different ordination techniques. Principal component relies on linear relationships in terms of its assumptions and normally distributed data. There are some non-linear NMDS and other ordination techniques that offer different strengths and opportunities for data analysis, and those have been used more for especially community analyses. You see them a lot with microbial community analysis. So some of the pros of these are that you can integrate many variables into single integrated axes and quantify their relative contributions to your outcome variables of interest. Okay. But then the other challenging thing is that we know that functions change over time. So when you measure, things matter, right? And they shift over time. So this is going back to that cover crop spider plot that I showed earlier, and looking at that soybean, wheat, corn three-year rotation with and without rye or red clover in there. And again, this is just modeled output, but just try to simulate the dynamics that happen over a three-year period in terms of nitrate leaching, where if you have to come up with some integrated measures, but you might miss hot spots depending on when you measure things. Beneficial insect conservation and the seasonal dynamics that happen. So one way we might leverage this, though, from cropping system studies is through high-frequency sampling. So I want to share one example that Denise Finney did a really nice analysis on a cropping systems experiment where soil nitrate had been extracted every 2 weeks during the growing season over about a five-year period. And this just shows that five-year period for one cropping system. And so there were eight replicates, basically, of this across different site years and across different studies. The dotted lines here show disturbance events, whether it was plowing, manure applications, or cultivation, or other disturbance events. And so basically, she leveraged not comparing the systems to each other, but leveraged this diversity of management factors into one model looking at what drives that inorganic nitrogen dynamics. So looking at classification and regression trees. So, surprise, surprise, inorganic nitrogen is driven by temperature and climate. That was the primary driver. But from there, then, what these numbers show is the relative breaking down the variability in that inorganic nitrogen by different classifications of factors. So, how many days since plowing? So, soil disturbance, how recent soil disturbance was one of the most important things. And then manure additions were on there. So, it was a way to just partition out the variability over time in response to different management factors. So regression trees, again, partition these variants in sort of a hierarchical, so again, which things maybe matter most in terms of the variability. It does not assume normal distributions or linear relationships, so it's conducive to pulling together different variables that have different distributions. One of the challenges, it doesn't have our traditional lack of goodness of fit test, but there are plenty of ways to look at the strength of some of these trees and tools. So I think it's a valuable tool that we could think about looking at our cropping systems experiments from a different perspective of not comparing system to system, but we have a lot of data in those sites that could be partitioned out to look at what's driving what in which year, maybe independent of the actual systems. And then thinking about semi-arid systems, one of the big challenges is there is the huge climatic variability year to year. Wet years, drought years, really dry years. It swings so much from year to year, it can be difficult to tease out change trends over time. So the abiotic forcing is very strong. And those soil carbon variables, we're already working with low carbon soils, can be even slower to change in those. So to some extent, it's even more important to have long-term experiments, I think, out there. So I think one interesting study that came out recently is, can we use that climatic variability to look at resilience of systems? So this isn't a multivariate approach, but I think just an interesting recent paper by Gowden et al. Looking at cropping systems in Ontario, where the black line here is continuous corn from 1982 to 2012, and these are corn grain yields over that time period, and then cropping systems of increasing diversity, basically. So F being soybean, W wheat, oats, barley, and the RC, they had some systems with red clover in there. What they saw is that yields had increased over time, largely due to improvements in crop genetics and other factors. But what they could do is partition out the variability over time, and they found that the corn yields were consistently higher. The yield variability was lower in those more diverse rotations, and that was even more so the case in dry years. So they showed increased resilience over time in those systems. And I've been eyeing that, thinking we need to apply that to some of our system studies out in semi-arid regions. And then I saw a talk recently by Bill Parton at CSU, who developed the Century model along with others. And they are working on some data right now looking at the Pacific decadal oscillation. So basically, variability is sort of decadal time scales of the Pacific Ocean, the sea surface temperatures, that take this episodic pattern, and they're now linking that to productivity in the Great Plains area. So this is short grass steppe above ground primary productivity during periods of warm sea temperatures in the Pacific and cooler soil temperatures in the Pacific. And they're finding greater productivity during those warm periods and lower year-to-year variability. And this is exactly what the pattern, I mean, everybody talks about how there was the wet period of the 80s and the dry period of the past decade in our region in terms of looking at yields in these cropping system studies. But I think there's a lot we can leverage working with modelers, too, who are looking at these longer trends and integrate some of the mechanisms that might be driving those climatic differences and looking at the variability piece in our long-term systems experiments. So the other piece in thinking about, if we're going to do this, we're going to leverage these data sets to ask more questions, we need more people of different disciplines involved. And so this is something that I've been working on after my experience working with really great teams out in Pennsylvania, is pulling in weed scientists, entomologists, and other folks, modelers, into thinking about different aspects of these cropping systems experiments that have been in place for 30-plus years. What does that mean for weed dynamics? You know, especially thinking about herbicide-resistant weeds in our region, do more diverse rotations break up that and reduce the risk of developing herbicide-resistant weeds? Those are challenges. Maybe our research plots aren't necessarily designed to get at some of that, but maybe we can answer some of those questions with our on-farm systems. And so coming at this, we need to pull together a diversity of collaborators, and we also need to think, again, I think broader sort of landscape scales, and pulling in on-farm sites as well as our research sites to look at the relative importance of what we're seeing at research sites, and does that scale up to the landscape and on-farm sort of context. So that was a whirlwind tour through analysis approaches, and I probably can't answer any of your statistical questions, but I'll try to answer any broad general questions. So thank you for your time. Which one? So actually, no. At this point, no. So the principal, the PATH analysis was a self-taught group effort where we actually had a bunch of graduate students and postdocs that taught ourselves PATH analysis. So it's been more ecologists and biologists and agronomists working together on these methods. Yeah. It's looking at how people have looked at multiple variables in different contexts, and then I think finding people who've used the methods and understand the underlying stats, right? So it has to be a collaborative. You have to find someone who knows what they're talking about in terms of the statistical analyses and different approaches. Yeah, but we haven't pulled a statistician in yet into the team for these approaches. Sure. Can I say that? It's a work in progress, but yes, you know, and I think that we could leverage a lot if we did some cross-regional collaborations, for example. I think that would be great, but I wouldn't say we're established, but we're, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, anytime you're doing on-farm, you're introducing a lot more variability, right? Which is why we do research taste and experiments, is to minimize that and have a little more control on the management. So on-farm research requires a greater number of sites to account for that. But because of that, you end up with larger data sets to some extent. I think it's more conducive to some of these multivariate approaches because you're working with more variable and larger data sets. I am not officially. So yes, it is. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So a couple of fronts we have going right now. So we have someone now, Sarah Ward, who's looking at weed communities at those long-term plots to try to look at those dynamics. I have a partnership with the USDA folks, Laj Ahuja's group in Fort Collins, who's doing some carbon modeling and specifically looking at Lucretia Sherrod, who has a poster on that experiment actually tomorrow evening that shows some of those yield differences between the wet and dry years. So go visit that poster. But she's measured a lot of these different soil fractions, labile carbon, particulate organic matter, and he's looking at to what extent can we look at those measured fractions and changes over time, which you only get in these long-term experiments, and to what extent do those correlate to the modeled pools we have in models? And can we improve how we model carbon in these models by looking at changes in measured pools or vice versa? So that's one other way we're looking at it.